It's the weekend, and you have financial questions that need answering. That can only mean one thing. It's time for Jill on Money, the show that takes the mystery out of your finances. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
Welcome to Jill on Money. Thank you so much for joining us. So happy when I get to hear that music. I'm sure that in my later years, as I'm lying there decrepit, that music will be the soundtrack of my decline because I hear it over and over again. We're not changing it yet. Maybe we should change it. Maybe we should swap it for the podcast music. Maybe we should have that in there. No way. Mark likes it. All right. We need some new music going on. I know you're very busy, but I know. It's brutal. Maybe just go back to the old music. Yeah, Mark needs an assistant, he says. Oh, I know. So wait till you hear. Well, you know what? I just read a book, and I don't want to say the name of the guest because the guest may already have been aired. But so many people who have businesses say, like, the key to life is an assistant. They're wrong. The key to a very smooth business life is having a fantastic producer like Mark. But Mark, you can go get your, why don't you get yourself an intern? Figure out how that make that work. He says it might be more trouble. We've had some good interns in the past. Who's your favorite? Yeah, that mine too. I can't say that on the air because that would be mean. All right. Let's talk to Steve. He's calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Steve, welcome to Jill on Money. What can I do for you?
Yeah. Hi, Jill. How are you?
Good.
So I'm 58. My wife is 55. We're both working. And my question is about my 401k, which is with my former employer.
Okay.
And I want to know how to minimize taxes.
Okay.
So essentially, I'm retired from one company. I'm still working now. So you can break up that 401k into three pieces, the after-tax, which is $590,000, the ESOP, which is $580,000, and the before-tax, which is $700,000.
Okay.
And the cost basis on the ESOP company stock is $42,000.
Oh.
So I know... So,
excuse me, that hurt me. Okay.
Okay. That's why I'm calling. That doesn't hurt me yet. So I know you can do a neat thing with this. You know, once you retire with a former 401k, you can save future taxes by converting the after tax to a Roth,
right?
And the company stock to common stock, future capital gains versus, required minimum withdrawals at your marginal tax rate. So that's
right.
Good. So that's all the good stuff.
Right.
Right. But the bad stuff is, say I do it now, I have to pay taxes on the cost basis.
Right.
At my marginal tax rate, which...
Wait a minute. You have to pay taxes just you have to pay taxes on the difference between the cost basis and the current value.
Well, I'm not going to take all that capital gains.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to pay future taxes.
Okay.
So I only have to pay taxes on the 42, is my understanding.
Okay. I got you. So you're saying you have to pay ordinary income tax on the 42.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then I'm going to have to start paying dividends.
Mm-hmm.
Common stock.
Right.
So there's like good stuff out in the future.
Right.
Like all those after tax. Once it's in a Roth, that means any earnings that make will get rolled into the Roth.
Right.
Right. So that grows nicely.
Right.
All that magic of compounding and all that. But the bad part is I have to pay taxes now. So how do I, I'm only 58.
Yeah.
Start paying taxes now, or do I wait until I'm closer to retirement, which might be around 62?
How much are you making now?
160, but my wife makes more than I do.
I love your wife. How much does she make?
Like having a good assistant, right?
Yeah, exactly. How much does your wife make?
Like 280.
Okay. And is she, in that 280, you whittle it down? In other words, she's making contributions to her retirement account?
Yeah, she's making it's her own business, so she's making whatever, the 50 grand, whatever.
Okay, great. If you looked at the lower bottom right corner of your tax return, what's the adjusted gross income?
Oof.
Do you have a guess?
I think it's like 350, 380.
And is your 160 going to decrease anytime soon? Is it
probably
is it,
not?
Not. Yeah. Okay.
No.
This is an interesting situation, right? Because you've got, like, on one hand, you just like, oh, I want to, like, get this done. But you are making a lot of money. So there's two things. One is, you know, we're probably going to get some tax reform, right?
Mm.
So I certainly wouldn't do anything until I were to see what your situation might be under a new tax regime. Because I do think that, you know, we don't know the details yet, but under either the proposed Trump plan that he was talking up last year when he was campaigning, and if I look at last summer's release of the Congressional Republican plan, something in between those two would probably be maybe where we end up. And what I know is that the benefit of those cuts would go quite nicely to someone like you, because, you know, you probably don't feel this way, but, you know, you're like in the top 1 or 2% of earners. Right. And I know that when the plans were scored, about it would be almost like as if you got a savings of about 10% of your adjusted gross income in tax reduction. So I certainly would not do a thing until I saw what that plan was.
Okay.
Then the next thing I would look at is, what is the implication of doing nothing until your income really goes a lot lower? And this may be something that you want to hire. Do you work with a CPA right now?
Yes. He prepares our tax.
Okay.
For like tax advice, though. I think I need to start doing that.
And maybe what I would do is this. I would, you know, let's see what the plan is when it comes out. Then what I would do is, after tax season, you know, when things are settled down, contact the tax preparer and say, look, I've got a project for you. I'd like you to look at this. Under this new tax regime, I'd like you to show me what the implication would be of doing something this year or next year, or waiting until our income goes down more dramatically. And I think that when you have that in mind, that will give you a more informed way to make this decision. Look, this is like an embarrassment of riches, right? You've got a ton of money you've saved. You've done a great, great job of saving. The most important thing for you to do at this point is to minimize the impact overall of all this great saving that you've done, and then slowly but surely convert as much as you can to, you know, obviously take the after tax portion and get that to a Roth, and then be looking at how we can manage the ESOP over time. First, that initial hit, and then dribble out the capital gains. So a little more information, Steve, but I think patience will serve you well. And I think this tax environment is going to do you a lot of good. You are listening to Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Annuities, IRAs, 401ks, she covers it all. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. I'm Jill Schlesinger. If you have a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. You can follow us on Twitter @JillOnMoney. I think, Mark, that you've just sort of given up on your own Twitter handle. Just kind of watch. How are we doing? Are we getting any more people? Not really. We're stuck. We're stuck at what, like 11? 10? 11,000 Twitter followers? Yeah. Oh, 13? That's not bad. It's all right. Got to get a bump up. I'm not sure how. And Mark says he's not sure it matters. But anyway, if you like the Twitter, if you get like you're on the Twitter monitoring political life, hop on. Check us out. All right. Let's answer an email question. And we've got one here from Lillian who would like some advice about how to draw from investments to sustain a long retirement. So Lillian has assets with Vanguard in a 60-40 split between stock index funds and bond index funds. Also have about 20% in non-retirement funds. We're looking at a 30-year time horizon. They're going to plan to travel for 15 years and assisted living for 15 years. Maybe you don't need all 15 years, but okay. We would like to preserve our principal and minimize tax consequences. Our current plan is to draw down 4% of our total assets per year in monthly or quarterly draws. What would your advice be? You know, this is kind of interesting. First of all, you didn't give me the amount of money that you're drawing down. This idea of a 4% withdrawal rate has sort of been the big number that is used among financial professionals over time. Now, there are some people, some financial CFP wonky types, who have really tried to crunch the numbers. And they say that maybe 4% is not actually the right number. Maybe it should be something more like 3% because they think that we are in not just low interest rate, but a low return world where you're not going to get, looking forward in the next 30 years, the same kind of investment returns that we have gotten in the past. So 4% might really be more like 2.9%. That's one way of looking at it. Others say we're kind of going at it the wrong way, that we should be looking at withdrawals based on the performance in a given year. So they say that you would look at and say, hey, if I had a great year in the market, I could take a little bit more money out. But if I have a rotten year, I would have to pull back on the amount of money that I withdraw. So maybe one year it would be a 3.9% withdrawal rate, and the next year it's a 1.9% withdrawal rate. I always feel like that's a tiny bit complicated in my mind, but that's me. I mean, I think most people kind of like a straight line. If you're really looking for just some stream of income, I think what's best to do is to not pull out some arbitrary percentage, but to really look at what your needs are. I mean, if you don't need to pull 4% out, it certainly would be better if you could pull out less, right? So it's not a bad game plan. I think it's okay. I think you're going to have to really be very careful about not pulling too much money out early in your retirement. I think that's, you know, assisted living may mean a big chunk of money that you want to have available to you. I get that you want to travel, but I guess what I'm saying is that it's somewhere between 3 and 4%. I think you should be mindful of the investment environment. But generally speaking, I think that's a pretty good way of approaching retirement. You look ahead, you say, what do I need? And then you hope that you can pull out less than 3% if you can do it. There are some who are more comfortable pulling out more. I hesitate to pull out a lot of money early in retirement years. That's my big piece. So good luck. Let me know if you have more questions. Mark writes that he listened to our Better Off podcast with David Bach and has a question about IRAs. He says, my young adult children are going to open an IRA this year. I wanted your opinion, traditional versus Roth. I understand the difference between the two. I can't find articles where head-to-head comparison is made, given the same amount, blah, blah, blah. Mark, for younger people, especially for, you know, when you're talking about, you know, your young adult children, I always would say a Roth. Absolutely, positively, chances are they are going to be earning more money later in life. So I would no doubt, I would use the Roth for younger kids. Here we go. Here's somebody who is Pat. Okay. So here's somebody who say, congratulating me on my new role as a CFP senior ambassador. Thank you very much. So Pat has a question regarding career, and he says, I am a CEO, just turned 62. I'm in the process of selling my third successful learning and development company. I don't intend to retire. I'm taking lots of time to think about my next adventure. I've always been good at financial matters and also as a mentor, business advisor, life coach, etc. for clients, friends, and family. For a few years, I've been thinking seriously about getting a CFP, becoming a full-time financial planner as my next life career, given my experience owning and growing multiple businesses. I feel I could bring a lot of unique value to the table. Am I crazy to think a 62-year-old could successfully earn a CFP credential and establish a second career as a financial planner? I am in excellent health. I've got great energy. I'm very good at building personal relationships. I'd be eternally grateful for your thoughts, opinions, ideas. Thanks in advance. You know what? I absolutely think this is a great idea, Pat. Why not? You know, you've got life experience and you're good at building relationships. Learning the nuts and bolts of becoming a certified financial planner is not going to be hard for you. It's not. And I think that it's awesome, as a matter of fact. And, you know, you're going to hear, there'll be a drumbeat of people saying, like, why are you going to do this? Why? Do it. Why not? Mark's starting to do the CFP, just taking his first course right now. It's a beautiful thing. I say go for it. And I think it's a great idea. I love the profession. I mean, it's just like amazing because for all people at different points in your life, I think the one thing that is clear is that you like to have control over your time. And I think when you're a financial planner and you become a CFP, once you get up and running, you really can have a lot of control over your time. You can have a small practice. You can be part of a big practice. You can immerse yourself. There's so many different parts of it that are great. Pat, I would absolutely encourage you to head over to the CFP website. So CFP.net. If you want, just go to my website. I have a direct link to it at the top of my webpage at jillonmoney.com. I think that it's really important that you know what you're getting into, but I think it's a fabulous idea. I really do. It's really cool. Fun. It's a lot of work, I know, but the guy's motivated. Half the battle is being motivated, right? And he's going to have the time to do it. So anyway, there you go. You are listening to Jill on Money. This is the program that does take the mystery out of your financial life. If you have a financial question, 855-411-JILL, send us an email. Our email address is askjill@jillonmoney.com. And check out our new podcast, Better Off. You can get it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. It's a little different than, similar to the radio show, just like a slightly different, it's like a cousin, you know? So shorter, less of an investment. All right. When we return, we are going to get to more of your questions. It's Jill on Money. We'll be right back.
It doesn't matter if you're 25 or 65, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Back to Jill on Money.
I'm so in love with you. You're back with Jill on Money. Mark and I are kind of grooving to this. Love this song. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. 855-411-JILL, that is our phone number. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. William wrote in that in 2009, he purchased an annuity. And over the years, he said that both my tax and bank advisors have both independently have said that the surrender percentage charge in this contract is almost criminal. So, guys, you know what happens when you buy any kind of life insurance product, whether it's a life insurance policy that has a cash value in it, or it's an annuity, there is usually something called a surrender charge that is attached to that. What that means is you put the money in, but if you want to just blow out of it, you've changed your mind, there's usually a charge that is levied to get out, to surrender your contract. And, you know, it used to be that it was kind of like not that big a deal. It would maybe be 5% in the first year and it would go 4, 3, 2, 1. But then all of a sudden, these surrender charges started to get higher and last for a longer period of time. Some of them even 10-year surrender periods, which is crazy. So that's a big component in one of why some of these policies are really tough to get out of. It's just that it costs you so much to get out. Now, that said, William says that he has been, quote, heartsick to think that he was duped into signing on to this with a broker from a company and from a person who I trusted. And he says, I feel like there should be some investigation into this practice of charging these surrender charges on unsuspecting clients. Talk about being held up to the fiduciary standard. Start here. Well, okay, so let's just like break this down a little bit. Number one is, that person who sold you that is probably not held to the fiduciary standard. So that's number one. The other thing is that whenever you're buying, I want everyone to just think about this. If somebody is presenting me with an opportunity to purchase something, okay, it can be a mutual fund, it could be a life insurance policy, it could be an auto policy, it could be an annuity contract. When some salesperson offers that to you, your first question is, how much will this cost me upfront? There is usually an upfront fee. How much? It's a very easy question, right? The next question, how much will it cost me each year that I'm in this investment? 1%, 2%, all in, every single fee, how much will it cost me? And then third is, how much does it cost me to get out? Now, here's the problem. Chances are that when William was sold this big annuity contract, that all this information was there, that he got this big fat prospectus. It was the surrender charge was probably in there. It's not as if the broker was going to circle it and say like, hey, don't forget here, like 10% first year, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. It's not like that. They don't usually do that. So if you have somebody who is a salesperson who is not held to the fiduciary standard, and even if he or she is, still ask the question, how much will this cost me? How much will this cost me up front? How much will this cost me each year that I'm in the investment? And what is the cost to get out? How long does that surrender charge period work? This is a way for you to gather more information. And you know, unfortunately, William, I understand that you trusted this person and you feel duped. It may not be exactly that you were duped, but it could be that you just didn't know the right questions to ask. So if everyone out there is starting to listen to these kinds of conversations and wondering, how can I protect myself? You can almost always ask those three questions. You can come back to, are you a fiduciary? And you can gather up the information you need, but don't buy anything. And by the way, if you are sold something or someone puts a potential, a product or service in front of you and you feel somewhat unsure about it, put on the brakes. Listen to the little flutter in your belly. There's some sort of yellow or red flag that goes up and stop. Don't sign anything. Send us an email. Just send us an email. It's so easy. Ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. Hey, Jill, I was just offered this opportunity to buy this thing. What do you think? We'll either bring you on the show, we'll follow up with some questions, we'll give you our best advice. Your role as a client in the financial service industry is that you are entitled and should be asking all of these questions. If you don't ask these questions, then you might have a situation like Williams, where you're looking back and saying you feel like you got duped. And again, it may have been perfectly legal what went on. It may have even been appropriate advice for William based on what he told this broker, salesman, advisor. I don't know. But what was clear is that William did not understand the fee structure, nor did he understand the cost to get out of this policy over time and what that might entail. So just like you go and price any goods or services that you and your family are seeking, you're going to go to a car dealership and you're looking at this car and you're saying, how much does this cost? And then, you know, you're kind of on guard, I think, when you go into an auto dealership these days, and you probably have a lot of information. You've probably gone online and know what the cost of the car is to the dealer, and you can go in there and knock out a good deal. The same is now true with financial services. Because this fiduciary standard is not the law of the land, because your financial professional may or may not be telling you something that's in your very best interest, or may not be clearly delineating the conflicts of interest or the fees that are out there, you have to ask for yourself. I'm sorry, I know that's a little bit more work for you, but I think it's well worth it in order to avoid situations like these. So, William, thank you so much for writing and helping me bring that out into the light. All right, you are listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. That is our phone number. Don't forget to leave your name and tell us what's going on. You can also send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
It's Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. Have a question? Call or email anytime, 855-411-JILL, or ask Jill at jillonmoney.com.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, just let us know, because this is the program for you. Give us a call, 855-411-JILL, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. Ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. And remember, if you miss any part of the program, you can always go to the website, jillonmoney.com, click on the radio tab, and maybe you didn't hear the beginning of this show, you're getting in and out of your car, you were walking on the beach. I don't know what you're doing, but you're busy. So you can't be necessarily listening for 2 hours in a row, maybe an hour and 15 or so without all those commercials. So go check us out, jillonmoney.com. Click on the radio tab. And by the way, you can also check out our new podcast. It's called Better Off. You can get it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. Better Off with me, Jill Schlesinger. Okay, let's go do a bit of a email cleanup, because I know there's a lot of stuff coming in. Remember, when you are actually sending us an email, your name, your little bit about your situation, so we have some information for you. Same when you call. When you call, leave your name, leave a little quick description on what's on your mind, and then Mark will give you a call back. Okay? All right. Erica from Jupiter, Florida says that she discovered us a few weeks ago when I was a guest on the Stacking Benjamin show, which is a fun show, by the way. And she says, listen to all your shows after that, and now I anticipate it every week. Thanks for the time, all your great advice. You got some cool guests, and I'm learning a lot from your show, and I promise to leave a rating on iTunes. Yes! Fantastic. Okay. Erica wants to know, just wondering what your thoughts are on IULs. IUL, indexed universal life insurance. Okay? Erica says, IULs, this is, I've heard, is another investment vehicle that can be used in lieu of a 401k or a Roth IRA or along with it. Just your general thoughts on it. I am a little skeptical. I don't know enough about the product. I don't know what the management fee structures are. Seems like in a down market with a guaranteed return, it's pretty good. And you can probably lose out on an up year when you've got a capped percentage of the index. I know each person has his or her own personal financial situation, but Just wanted to get your ideas and thoughts of the overall product. Okay. Now, here's the thing. Number one, if you've listened to this show at all, you know that generally speaking, I'm not a huge fan of these deferred insurance products, whether they be life insurance products themselves, like an actual life insurance policy or an annuity. The thing that happens is that when you go through a really bad down market, the insurance industry comes up with yet another flavor of how to be an investor inside of an insurance policy wrapper. And usually what happens is that those are extraordinarily expensive ways to invest. So what happens with any kind of universal life insurance policy is you put the money into the policy, and whatever is in excess of the premiums, the amount of life insurance, gets credited to the policy itself. There's some cash value. Now, the thing that's kind of crazy about this is that maybe for someone like in your case, or someone who, I don't know how old you are, but if you don't have a life insurance need, paying for life insurance is a very expensive way to invest. But the benefit of life insurance is that the money that grows inside that policy grows without taxation on a tax-deferred basis. But again, this idea that what they're doing in the policy is sort of saying, don't worry if you're a stock market investor. We will actually be careful because in a down market, we'll make sure that you don't lose too much. We'll give you a guaranteed minimum interest rate. And on the upside, when the market goes up, you won't make as much as you would have if you just owned the index fund. You'll get a portion of that. Okay, so the problem for this is, if you don't need life insurance, it's expensive. Second thing is that it's really expensive anyway. The fees are pretty amazing. And the fees and the costs that are associated with these policies are not just the mortality and expense risk, but the cost of insurance. But there's a surrender charge if you surrender the policy. The cost of actually owning the investment inside the policy is expensive. So in my mind, The IUL universe is something that is probably an interesting idea for a high-income investor who has a maxed out every other possible and exhausted every other possible way to invest on a tax-deferred basis and also needs life insurance. But even that, I can't even say that would be the kind of insurance I'd want the person to have. So in my mind, Erica, what I think is most important for you is to probably take your 401k, take your Roth IRA, take your general investment account, use that. And before you start pouring money into a life insurance product, be very clear about the costs associated with it, the rules about how long you have to stay in, what it would cost to get out, and whether that really makes sense for you. My guess is, in 9 times out of 10, is that it doesn't make sense. So I would most likely try to avoid that product. Again, not every single person, but 9 times out of 10. All right. You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back with more of your questions. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 855-411-JILL, or send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. That's what Ed did, who says he's got a question regarding his financial planning agreement. Ed and his wife have been with a financial advisor for the last 15 years. He says they're both 65, and then he, the advisor, brought up the idea of entering into a financial planning agreement. My question to you is, says Ed, would there normally be a fee for this service? If so, what would the typical fee be? I enjoy your column. He reads my column in somewhere, I don't know where, and appreciate any advice. Okay, here's the deal. You may have had what you thought was a financial advisor. My guess is you had somebody who was just an investment person. And maybe that person did not do financial planning for you. But usually when you're having someone manage your money for you, or you've paid someone a commission to sell you some mutual funds, they will usually throw in a little financial planning on the side. So I think that what you really need to figure out is, number one, what is the arrangement that you have actually had previous to this point? What were you paying this advisor? And what services were you getting for that, the service? What services were you getting for the fee that you were paying? And then the next question is, what kind of financial planning services is he saying that he will provide for you? I mean, you're 65. You're probably thinking about retirement. What exactly will those services mean? In many cases, when you just go out and you hire someone to simply put together a financial plan, that can be a flat fee. I mean, you can pay $1,000 for that. You can pay $3,000 for that. You can pay $15,000 for that. It kind of depends on the complexity of your situation. In your case, Ed, I would be very wary of signing any agreement before I had a real handle on what this advisor was planning to do for you. All right? Give me a call if you have another question about that, because I know you might want to have a follow-up on that. All right, it's Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Stay tuned. We've got more of the show coming right up. Well, I need-